And we'll edit afterwards. Good afternoon, everybody. I am so excited. We're a Real Talk with Lisa Patrick right now, and I've got Bob Stenhouse on. Bob, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Lisa. Pleasure to be here with you.
Likewise, likewise. And Bob is here locally in Edmonton, and so at some point, him and I are going to have to go for lunch.
We will. I mean, we've gone over that COVID thing where we never even considered it. Now we can.
Yeah, exactly. So Bob, you know, I've followed you for some time and likewise, but tell me a little bit about your career and really, you know, some of the navigational, where we're all, if you will, of, you know, where you started to where you are today. And I know that it was a bit of a bumpy ride, so.
It has been a bumpy ride, Lisa. As you're aware, I began my career in the RCMP back in 1982. I was 20 years old, and I often ask, what were they thinking giving a 20-year-old a badge and a gun? From what we understand about the development of men's brains, apparently we're not developed till we're about 25. So inevitably, I knew right from the get-go that policing suited my personality and my sense of adventure and sense of justice and doing the right thing for our community and our society. But I was really interested in undercover work right from the get-go. Yeah. I was a, you know, I grew up in the 70s and you know, watched the old shows of, you know, Miami Vice and Hill Street Blues and NYPD Blue. And I was always, I was not all that interested in writing traffic tickets, to be honest. I really wanted to get into organized crime, high profile type of drug enforcement, biker gang enforcement, that type of thing, which I did. I ended up doing that for many, many years. And I was also involved in a, I was one of the pioneers on a team that pioneered what was called Mr. Big Investigations. And for your listeners, you can Google that. It's called the Canadian Technique. And what it was we would infiltrate a suspect in a homicide case in an undercover capacity, gain their confidence through a number of different scenarios that we would do with them, where they would believe that we were gangsters and criminals and hitmen and drug dealers and gun dealers and those types of things. And when we gain their confidence, inevitably get a confession to the homicide. Two of my cases, I was brought to the body. Pretty wild and crazy stuff. You know, it's called the Canadian Technique. It was so interesting because no one else was doing this back in the early 1990s. It is controversial. There has been some cases that that I believe rightfully so have held police to a higher level of responsibility with the technique. And very, very successful. I ended up doing that for a number of years, and I was in charge of biker gang enforcement in Edmonton here. And I ended up becoming a whistleblower when I became privy to what I call the politics of policing as related to budget.
Gotcha. Well, and it's interesting because, of course, your path, although much more advanced into the policing world than mine was very similar, because I grew up, you know, my father was an RCMP officer, and I had always wanted to be a cop and undercover. And, you know, it just that there was no deciding anything other. I wasn't going to be a secretary. I wasn't going to be a farmer. I wasn't going to be a lawyer. You know, I wasn't going to be a dentist. I was going to be a cop. And, you know, it's interesting about, you know, six months onto the job. And I'm like, yeah, this is not for me. But, you know, private enterprise, there was more money. It was a different time. It was in the early 90s. You know, I was in sex crimes. There was only one woman in the division. Like, things were just very different. And so, Bob, you know, being a whistleblower and being forced out of the RCMP to have a federal Supreme Court injunction to say, no, this was not a valid dismissal. And then quietly retiring afterwards, for those of you who are wondering what happened for Bob, how did you get to be doing the workplace investigation work that you're doing today? How did that start that new trajectory in your career?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. When I left policing, I was kind of one of those that said, I don't want to do anything related to policing. I want to really try something different. I actually went into, I was a family counselor for a while. I worked in the inner city, working with the homeless. And so I have this, what I call my Forrest Gump years. And inevitably, it brought me back to, I'm an investigator. It's what I do. It's what I'm good at. And so I ended up being a private investigator back in the early 2000s.
Likewise.
Yeah. Oh, likewise. Yeah. Exactly. Well, I think that's how we connected, Lisa. I saw
yeah,
I saw one of your posts. I said, well, that's interesting. I didn't realize you did PI work.
Yeah, I did PI work. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realized that you had done PI work. I didn't know that you had done that as well. So
yeah, I had primarily in the area of mostly workplace, corporate, and human rights. Yeah. And I got really
You know Dave Rodwell?
What's that, sorry?
Do you know Dave Rodwell?
Yes. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Dave and I sat on the Alberta Private Investigators Board back in the day.
I went to some of the meetings way back when, and I remember meeting Dave at those meetings as well. Yeah.
Interesting. Interesting how paths cross and then, you know, depart and come back again.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah. And so, yeah, I got really interested in human rights types of investigations. Yeah. So a lot of interviewing, I ended up joining Alberta Health Services. And of course, again, for your listeners, Alberta Health Services is the largest employer in Alberta and the largest health authority in Canada. And I had an opportunity to actually develop from the ground up a corporate investigations unit. So I did that back between the years of 2008 and 2018. So if you can think of every deep, dark, ugly thing that could happen in healthcare related to employee behavior, right up to physicians and surgeons, it basically came across my desk and I was either part of investigating or managing the investigations.
Wow. And now fast forward to today, you have your own company and still focusing on workplace investigations.
Yeah, absolutely. It's actually interesting. We actually have, we've expanded. I began just myself in 2018. We've got about 25 investigators across Canada. We have directors that work and basically coordinate and supervise streams. So we do workplace investigations. We do regulatory investigations for the colleges. So College of Physicians, Surgeons, College of Nurses. We do sport investigations, which is a big hot topic, particularly with Hockey Canada and what's called the independent third party, which is one of our contracts that we have with Hockey Canada. And then we also have another stream that's very unique. We have one of our investigators has his PhD in theology, and he is our director of church and faith-based organization investigations. So primarily looking into either current or historical abuse in the church type of investigations. And that's a growing stream. So we're doing about 150 investigations a year right now, Lisa.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That's a lot of manpower.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, we're busy. We've got a great team, wonderful people. Everyone believes in what we do, and we're very collaborative. It's a dream team. I really like.
Which is so hard, right? Yeah. Like in today's day, especially through we had COVID. We're coming out of COVID. You know, I don't want to talk about COVID, but it's that whole center around what is the culture that we're creating, right? As we move forward and leaders are really reevaluating, what does that look like? And I know you do a lot of work in the HR space. So let's talk a little bit more about, culture and how are you really creating a culture where people feel like they can belong, but not only belong, but they can thrive and they can, they're encouraged to innovate. And especially around investigations, right? Because it's difficult. There's some secrecy to it. There's some hidden, agendas on the background as far as what you need to do and how you need to do it. And so let's talk a little bit more about how are you creating a great culture?
Yeah, well, it's interesting in terms of the culture of our own team. The nice thing about it is we're very like-minded. First and foremost, I'm an advocate, and I've taken my certifications in psychological safety in the workplace. From many lenses, both the psychological safety in terms of just having a place where you can show up, have an opinion without fear. And then from the other perspective, from psychological safety and the law, which of course comes into our investigation. So harassment, bullying, sexual harassment, discrimination. Those are our areas of expertise. So of course, I've always been one that I think that I probably, maybe I've had a misstep or two in my life, but tried my very best to walk my talk. And so if we're advocating both from an investigative lens as well as a leadership lens, advocating for healthy, belonging, inclusive, diverse teams, we need to walk our talk. And I believe we do.
Well, and I think, you know, creating belonging, and it's interesting, and I've just put on the bottom here, because you know that I'm partnered with Lauren Rubis.
Right.
We have a company called Belongify, which we, our mandate and our mission is to create cultures of belonging, right?
Right.
It's about how do you drive effective leaders to create the conditions for people to belong and thrive. And it's interesting because the first phase of that really is about connection. And you know, you do a lot of work with teams and leaders, and how are you driving that opportunity for leaders to really connect? Because I think at the base of everything, the foundation of everything, if you don't feel like you're connected, not just to your boss or to your leader, but to your coworkers, to your colleagues, to your clients, how do you really create thriving culture?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's interesting because our firm is a human resource risk management firm. And it's funny because we kind of, what we provide in terms of how we can help our clients is basically mitigating the risks of the circumstances that would cause people not to connect. And not to
conflict, like conflict resolution being
even more, I would say even more so that, you know, bullying, harassment. I mean, if someone becomes the target of a bullying campaign, they're disconnected. They're in pain. It's harmful. It hurts the culture. It hurts the team. And so they're disconnected. If someone is the target of a discriminatory campaign based on one of the protected grounds, whether it be race, whether it be sexual orientation, gender identity, if they've now become a target of harmful behavior, they're disconnected. And so we look at it, what we were able to provide.
Well, and Bob, let me interrupt for a second. Wouldn't you argue, though, that it's not just about the person who's being targeted, but it's also the person doing the targeting that's disconnected?
Yeah. And I would say probably disconnected from their heart.
Or they've got something else going on and they're projecting those emotions, right, onto somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You see projection. We see insecurities playing out. We see jealousies in the workplace. You know, people we're complex, right? And people have different motives for behaving certain ways. So in terms of belonging and connection, I would say that is a factor in our workplaces.
Yeah. And it's interesting because the work that we do at Belongify, we're often asked, you know, is this a fluffy thing? No, it's not a fluffy thing. You know, it's not, you're actually getting a return on action. It's not a return on investment. It's not, you know, you put a dollar, like marketing, right? You put a dollar in, you get $2 out, or you hope you get $2 out if anybody's good at marketing. But it's not the same. You can't evaluate it the same. You can't, the performance indicators are not the same. So in your line of work with the workplace, you know, violence and, you know, your investigations, what performance indicators are you looking at and evaluating?
Are you talking about the team that we have, or are you talking about what we see with our clients?
What you see.
Yeah. I would say if I were to paint the picture for folks in terms of performance indicators, high emotional intelligence. Does the behavior show that your leaders, your managers, your supervisors have high emotional intelligence, particularly in the three components of self-awareness? Are they aware of how they're coming across? self-regulation? Are they controlled and regulated, maybe when they get frustrated? And lastly, empathy is so important. The ability to put ourselves in someone else's shoes. And notwithstanding that, you can make tough decisions. And like you said, it's not warm and fuzzy. It's sometimes it's belonging is about sometimes making tough decisions. But can we put ourselves in someone's shoes and really understand their perspective? And so to me, emotional intelligence, psychological safety. Am I the type of person that invites feedback? Am I the type of person that actually encourages feedback? Am I the type of person that can make it safe in our team to provide feedback? So what we would argue, Lisa, like you said earlier, is more of the softer skills.
Yeah.
I think that the softer skills, as we all know, are hard. But that that's what I certainly look for. With our team, I look for, yes, they're competent at what they do. I have no doubt you won't get past the door unless you're competent. But you also have the character. You have to have the character that is highly emotionally intelligent, is psychologically safe. And there's a thing I think you're probably familiar with, Lisa. There's a I believe there's a professor out of Harvard, and he calls it the decency quotient. Yeah. And DQ. So we've got IQ. We have to be competent from an intelligence perspective. We got EQ. We have to be emotionally intelligent. And he calls it DQ, the decency quotient. And I think one of the things that I'm seeing in a lot of our work is that there's indecent behavior one person towards another. And so I would look for decency and kindness.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting you mentioned kindness, because there is a difference between being kind and being nice, right? And they often get confused, right? Like, and I think decency is a huge component. And I think the more we get into this virtual world and this more technical world, and I want to talk a little bit more about technology and some of the things that you're using as far as, you know, in the workplaces and the work, great work that you do. But I think decency is huge, but it's interesting because it's also subjective to the decision or to the definition of the person, and how I believe what decency is and what you believe decency is two different things. And so I think we always have to adapt to our behavior and modify according to the person that we're speaking with. And that's often hard to do when you're not curious enough to really listen to those indicators, right? And so how do you navigate through that? Because, you know, you could be having a leader who thinks that they're very decent and that they're kind and they're empathetic and they have a high emotional intelligence and a huge empathy factor. But in reality, the other people that he's dealing or she's dealing with don't believe that same awareness.
Right. Yeah, very interesting, man. I think it goes back to the old, you know, the golden rule versus the platinum rule, right? The golden rule being treat people as I want to be treated, the platinum rule being treat people the way they want to be treated. And I think a conversation, I mean, I teach on some of my courses the concept of respect, of course. That respect could look very different for you than it could look for me. How do we determine that? We talk. Hey, Lisa, what does respect look like for you? Well, Bob, when you come in the office in the morning and you don't say good morning to me, I feel disrespected. Oh, okay. I'm going to be aware of that. Now I'm aware. So I make a choice, right? So then I make a choice whether or not I say good morning. If I choose not to, then of course I'm purposely probably disrespecting you. So I think more conversation about our differences, more conversation about how we experience decency, respect, dignity in the workplace, I think it would go a long way, but a person has to be open to adapting, you know, to other people's expectations. I mean, I'm an old white guy. We have a very diverse team. I get brought up. I got to tell you a funny story, Lisa. I was brought up to do some leadership training up at one of the First Nations communities that in the winter is fly-in. You can't even access it. And I
was fighting for that in itself. What an experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, I've worked a lot in First Nations communities, and for whatever reason, they accept me, and I get along very well with First Nations folks. And, I believe I know why in a moment, but the story is, as I'm presenting, and I've got like hundreds of employees working for the band.
Yeah.
And I said, what are they thinking? They bring up an old white ex-Mountie to talk about leadership. I mean, and they love to refer to the creator. And I said, the creator's got a sense of humor here. And of course, we all laughed, and it connected us that I was able to poke a little bit of fun at myself, but also learn to connect from someone else's perspective and frankly, be a little bit humble and defer to the wisdom that the elders may have, and which I did as well. So to me, it's about, you know, understanding the other person, taking a moment to get out of our shoes. Me speaking is not about me, it's about them, and putting myself in their shoes and saying, I wonder how I would feel if an old white ex-Mountie was coming up to talk to me about leadership. And so by bringing down that type of, you know, kind of thoughts that could be potentially negative, it really kind of bonded us. And I had a great 3 days with a really good team up there.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up the golden rule versus the platinum rule, because I don't know if you know this, Bob, or not, but my business partner actually wrote the platinum rule. Tony Alessandra. So it's interesting because I have always believed, and long before I had ever even had known Tony or even knew that the gold or the platinum rule had existed, that it is really about adaptability, right? It's about meeting somebody where they're at, not necessarily where you think they need to be. And I often find that people are so busy imparting their wisdom on us that they're not actually stopping and thinking and listening to what that other person is saying, right? And enjoying the moment that is occurring. They're just so busy thinking about what am I going to say next or how I'm going to help somebody next, that lots of opportunity gets lost. Lots of opportunity for connection, lots of opportunity for, you know, relationship drivers, for, you know, all kinds of great opportunities for and possibilities for different things. So how do you believe that people can really understand their adaptability meter, meaning like they are highly in tune to that other person and that they're able to sit in the moment? And how do you teach that? How do you teach that of somebody who is a really direct personality and is go, 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 and has no patience and so forth? Because lots of times that personality is the problem in the workplace. Right.
And it could, you know, cross a line. Someone that's just direct and task focused can oftentimes cross a line where someone has perceived it to be bullying. And that's one of the things that we have to discern as investigators, right? Is it just an abrasive personality that's direct and is task focused, that's bulldozing over people, or is it actually bullying behavior? So we have to kind of look at that. For me, the idea of learning how to listen, I've got undiagnosed ADHD. I have no doubt. The more I understand about ADHD and my upbringing and my schoolwork, and so it's not surprising that I could be listening to someone and find myself, my brain going here, there, everywhere. And I find it's a real discipline, and it really is a choice. It really is a discipline to say, slow down. I want to listen. I want to hear. Do I do it perfectly? No. I've come a long way from that perspective. But I think it's just understanding the value of what that brings. If a person feels heard, then they are going to feel like they belong. Yeah. They are going to feel like this is a place I want to work. My leader is willing to understand my perspective. Who doesn't want that? I mean, I wanted that at 20 years old. Working in a paramilitary organization that basically...
As a kid, we want that. We want our parents to listen to us, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, as a leader, I put myself in the shoes of the persons that I'm required to lead. And I say, well, it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting because you brought up something. How do you judge? Like, do you go through like a checklist to determine some of these behaviors? Like, how as an investigator does that work?
Are you talking about like a behavior that could cross the line into the definition of harassment?
100%.
Well, it's from actually from a bit of a legal lens, what's called the reasonable person test. And so the definitions right across Canada for harassment are someone engages in an action, either one time or a series of behaviors that they know or ought reasonably to have known would cause offense, humiliation, or negatively impact their psychological safety. And so the key that we look at is that from an investigative lens, did it happen? And if it did happen, should that person know or ought reasonably to have known would cause offense? Right. And so what I say is that I'll give you an example. If someone chooses to drop the F-bomb every second word and use really harsh language and aggressive language and name call, they ought reasonably to know that would cause offense or humiliation to the person that's been directed. Right. Mm-hmm. And so it really is. And we were able to come to findings, even on what we call he said, she said investigations, based on that, based on credibility, a whole number of different factors in terms of how we investigate. Flip side, if someone is just maybe louder in personality, louder in their voice, and they speak like this all the time, and yet we realize that's not bullying, that's not harassment, that's just who they are. So we have to really make sure that we're discerning that from that reasonable person test.
Wow. It's fascinating work. How is technology has obviously advanced, even from the days of when I had my private investigation and we didn't have social media. Could you imagine if we'd had social media, how much easier our jobs would have been? So how has technology played a role in workplace investigations today, Bob?
I'd say for our types of investigations, obviously, like you said, I mean, the internet and open source information is helpful, right? Mm-hmm. So Googling people, what their background is, I mean, that's just, it's open source, it's out there. It does help us understand how to approach an investigation for sure. Yep. On the other side, in terms of just adapting to COVID and doing investigations online, I'm going to say something that some people find very surprising. Our investigators and I believe that we can do more effective investigations this way, virtually, than we used to do in person. I would have not believed that 5 years ago.
I want to deep dive into that. Yeah. Why do you believe that? Like, what are the indicators to prove that?
A couple of factors. The concept of interviewing has evolved. I've always been the type of person, even in my policing career, where I received a lot of information from people primarily because the way I approached it. Yeah. And friendly, firm, but friendly, collaborative, kind of conversational, like what we're doing here. Yeah. It's always been my style anyway. And the theory of investigation and interviewing has evolved to become like that. So I'll give you an example, Lisa. Where are you most comfortable? Where do you feel the most safe?
Of course, in your home, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so why would I want someone to come and sit in what I call the foyer of shame, out in front of the boardroom? HR is there, everyone's walking back, HR is here, everybody knows there's an investigation, causing all kinds of anxiety, stress, discomfort, and yet expect that I'm going to get maximum information. And so that's the one factor, is that when people are feeling safe, they're likely to give you more information. We want maximum information. Secondly, we don't believe in reading body language at all. And so we ask questions and we listen and we probe and we listen carefully. We test the evidence. We test the information against evidence we may have or someone else's perceptions. And so it's very, very conversational. And then we come down to what's called credibility assessments, and we assess the credibility of the person. And so with that, we have found that, and again, I personally, and I'd say all of our investigators agree that they much prefer to do it virtually.
Wow. Yeah. Well, there is something to be said for feeling safe, right? Safe enough, not feeling under the eyes and the watch of Big Brother, if you will, right? And Big Brother being the organization and the people within it. It's interesting. But what's really fascinating to me is no body language reading. That's interesting. So tell me about that. Because that I want to, I want to dive into that, Bob.
So years ago, I was taught reading body language. I'm talking about back in the 1980s, back in the 90s, take a couple of courses.
Yeah.
And, I was taught that, if someone looks up to the left when you ask a question, they're lying. If they look down to the right, they're doing this. And it's all been debunked. It really is considered to be a pseudoscience. It's been debunked by most, if not all, researchers that have done a real rigorous deep dive on the topic. And so, and then the other thing too, Lisa, is that unless I'm considered an expert in reading body language, which there's really no such thing, that if I were to put that in my report, a lawyer's going to look at that right away and say, wait a minute, what makes you an expert on reading body language? Well, you know, they crossed their arms when I asked them this question. Well, maybe they were cold. Well, they appeared to be nervous. Well, anyone involved in a workplace investigation is nervous.
He's nervous.
Right. So, you know, so it just kind of, it just really kind of, if you look at the history of reading body language, there's people out there making money teaching you how to become a human lie detector. And then there's people that are actually pushing back on that and saying, no, there's no such thing. At best, the tests going into that and the examination of that, you're at a 50-50. You could flip a coin. They're not speaking the truth. There they are.
Well, and I think too, placing more value on the questions that you're asking and the responses within, and how you're, you know, reiterating the comments and then re-asking questions differently, has more value than the bot, you know, am I cold or am I hot, or, you know, depending on the body language. I think there is a place for body language and perception of body language to a degree, I would argue, but I don't think that it is an indicator of deception or it's an indicator of truth for sure. I agree.
Agreed. And yeah, so don't get me wrong. You know, someone that's intuitive, that's, you know, got higher emotional intelligence, and that want to connect, it's good for them to observe someone that's uncomfortable, there's discomfort, there's, and to be able to kind of work with that, right? I totally agree. To reiterate the point, it's about determining deception as it relates to body language.
And it's interesting because I don't know about you, Bob, but this is always fascinating to me, and I don't know why. I always get genuinely surprised every single time it happens, when I should not be genuinely surprised anymore, but how uncomfortable people are in silence. And I, like, it's turned into a game for me, quite honestly. Like, I love the silence because the silence does make other people think about what you're asking, or the conversation that's occurring, or the actions that have been taken or not taken. But it's interesting how people are so uncomfortable with silence. They feel like they have to tell you something, right? So it does play a big role in investigations, obviously, but it plays a big role in life. And I'm curious, do you find that same thing, that people are just uncomfortable with silence? They don't know
what to do. Well, I'll give you an example of that. I was doing an investigation years ago when I was with Alberta Health Services, and I had asked a very, very tough question related to a sexual assault case. And I was working with an HR partner at the time, and the person I had asked a question of, the person alleged to have engaged in the misconduct, when I asked this very, very difficult question in a very polite, respectful way, his head went down. And it was a painfully long silence. And I looked at my HR colleague, and I could see that she was wanting to interrupt the silence. And I kept catching her eye and saying, no, let it sit, let it sit, let it sit. And it sat for about a minute. And that's a long time for
silence. It's a long time in silence.
Yeah. And then he looked up, and I said, that seemed to take a long time. Is there something you want to tell me? And then he just, his face erupted. He was bawling and crying and telling us the whole thing. So the idea that in an investigation, for sure, I teach, let the silence sit, but even in conversation and maybe critical, crucial conversations, right? To be able to really pick up on the give and take of a conversation, I think is critical as well.
Well, and it's interesting because I think that silence, people are uncomfortable with the silence, but they're also uncomfortable with the fact that they don't know the answer. And so they start to make up things, right? Like, because they don't want to be wrong, or they don't want to not have an answer, or so it's interesting because how often during, you know, you talk about crucial conversations, do you find that that's the case, and how do you weed that out?
Yeah. Let me think on that. It's, I think that when, particularly when you're having a crucial conversation, And again, I'm going to go back to emotional intelligence. If we all know, folks, Lisa, I'm sure that you are, because you're successful at what you do, you're likely very self-aware. Yeah. That you're self-aware of your emotions, you're self-aware of how you present, you're self-aware of how people are receiving you. Are you displaying warmth? Are you displaying, you know, a closed off? You're very self-aware. Some people aren't. Yeah. And so I think sometimes when you're having conversation with folks, if they haven't even considered whatever the topic might be from that perspective of self-awareness, it might actually be really uncomfortable, might stump them. Like, it's like,
And so
I think it really depends on you know, what might cause for that silence or being stumped. And then a good interviewer, of course, is able to probe a little bit, right? Yeah. And sometimes in our investigations, particularly, we may say something along the lines of, I can see this line is questioning is maybe a little bit challenging. Would you like to tell me about that? Right. So we're actually encouraging someone now. So a person has a choice. They can say, no, I don't want to tell you about that. Or my experience has been, when you actually ask, people will actually. It just seems like a natural flow.
Yeah. Interesting. Where'd you learn the? So, Bob, tell me a time when you were in an undercover investigate, or not an undercover investigate, but just a workplace investigation in the work that you do today, where you were pleasantly surprised with the outcome.
Pleasantly surprised. I have to admit that when it comes to the place where we're now investigating,
yeah.
I have not seen a lot of folks do the old, I did it. I behaved poorly. I want to accept full responsibility. I want to make it right. I want to apologize. I want to change my ways. I've not seen that a lot.
It's sad, isn't it?
It is.
Accountability to our actions, right? Like,
You know, and it's interesting, Lisa, going back to my own case when I was a whistleblower. I actually gave documents to an author, and he wrote a book, and the documents made it inside the book. And within 15 minutes, I went into my commanding officer and I said, don't look at anybody else. I'm the person that did it. I accept full responsibility.
Yeah.
And it was the best thing I could have ever done in terms of my own moral value, my own moral compass, my, who I want to be.
How old were you then, Bob?
What's that? Sorry.
How old were you then?
I would have been 38.
Yeah. So that's, you know, like the courage to do that, right? Like, let's talk a little bit about courage in the workplace and courage in that experience. Would have been, you know, you're 38 years old, married?
At the time, yes. I was in the middle of separation, divorce, but it all came down. My whole life came crashing down on me all at once.
So you blew a bomb on everything, in other words.
Oh, yeah. It was just a big, yeah.
How did you nab? Because that would have been an extremely emotional time. Never mind, like, you know, we try to separate, especially, you know, we try to compartmentalize, especially as investigators in the line of work that we've done and do. How do you separate the emotion from that? Because that would have been, I can't imagine the courage it took for you to raise your hand. Number one, the courage to even leak the documents, to set the documents first and foremost, which is the first action that was taken, right? But then to put your hand up and say, like, my personal life is blowing up. I'm now about to blow up my professional career and survive all that. Like, talk about that a little bit, because that's huge.
It's funny you say that, because I walked into the commanding officer's office and I said to him, I'm about to tell you something that is going to have a significant impact on my career.
Yeah. And I can't imagine the commanding officer going, that's not what I expect you to come and walk into my office for.
No. I've been on a spiritual journey my whole life, part and parcel of wanting to be the best version of myself. Right. The good, bad. We have our dark sides. We have the good, bad, ugly. And I think at that time in my life, on that journey, I was doing a lot of reading. And I remember distinctly what caused me to make that decision to self-disclose was I was reading Stephen Covey books at the time. And yeah. I remember distinctly that something that Stephen Covey wrote was, when you make a mistake, own your mistake, and you will be further empowered. And so I realized that, okay, I made an error in judgment in doing what I did. My reasons were good. My frustrations were very real. I did expose, some really, really egregious types of manipulation of the numbers to try to get budget and stuff like that. So my reasons were right. How I did it, how I expressed my frustration was probably ill-advised, and I erred. I should not have provided these documents. However, when I realized that, I went in and I thought I would be given a fair shake. And I was willing to take the accountability, but the problem, it became very, very political. Yeah. And I had the most powerful police chief in Canada call me corrupt and demand I get fired. And that's one of the reasons I won my case at the Federal Court of Canada, is that the ripple effect of that demand from a very senior leader opining on my my morals, my values, my who I am, as and calling a dedicated cop corrupt is going to be the worst thing that a cop could be called. You can call them lazy, you can call them maybe not all that bright, but calling them corrupt was
the integrity piece of it, right?
That's right.
Like, that's the piece. He challenged your integrity, and you knew you were being of sound. You know, it was your guiding post, really.
Yeah absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I've been probably over the, behind my back, in front of my face, whatever, said a lot of things, but that is the one thing. And I don't know, Bob, if it's because of our natural tendencies as investigators or who we were, but do not challenge my integrity. Mm-hmm. You can challenge anything, but that is the one thing that will set me off.
Yeah. And it's when you talk about integrity and living a life that we desire to live with integrity, and we desire to live with honesty and compassion. And when that happens and someone just, without even thinking about the power of the words, the most powerful police chief in Canada trying to influence the commissioner by calling me corrupt. And the reason being is that it was his strategy that was exposed. He was criticized in the book that was written. So he was angry. Yeah. And I find a lot of leaders, when they're angry, they will be tempted to misuse the power they have. And that's exactly what happened. He had a lot of power. He had very thin skin, was not appreciative of being criticized in whatever manner. And with that power, thin skin, he was criticized. Well, what's the best thing to do? Discredit the person that, that actually exposed your strategy.
And the sad thing about that is real leaders are accountable, right? And there was no accountability from his end on what, so that's interesting. But how did you, other than laying your head down on the pillow at night and knowing that you had done the right thing, how did you find the courage, though, Bob, truly to do what you needed to do to keep moving forward one step at a time? Because that takes guts.
Yeah, it's again, and the other part was that the other place where I think I probably really became a whistleblower is when I actually told my story. So I exposed the documents in the first instance, but then when I was called corrupt, I chose to tell my story. I've written about this on our website. I've written about it on my LinkedIn page. People could read it, read my version of events, and make their own decisions on whether or not they felt that I have integrity. Again, it was just, I had done so many things in my life that where I was required to be courageous in certain ways. I mean, so you start to develop the courage muscles.
Yep.
And I've always been, for lack of a better word, willing to challenge status quo, been a bit of a truth speaker, maybe not as polished in my younger days as I am now. But I would call Bravo Sierra when I saw it. And so with that, you kind of start to develop a little bit of a muscle there to say, no, I'm not going to go along with that. And so I think it was kind of the accumulation of building up those courage muscles for years. And frankly, at when I was at that place, I knew my career was over. I knew my policing career was over. I had a very promising career. I was on the, I was one of the youngest staff sergeants in Alberta history. I was on the list to become a commissioned officer. It was done. I knew it was done.
Yeah.
So now it's about reinventing myself, picking myself up, doing some deep soul searching, doing things that were good for me from a mental health perspective. What I haven't even touched on yet, Lisa, is that I was later diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. So the whole idea of coming out of that, and still it can be a journey as well. So I've always been one that's been, I'm driven by this idea that there's a bigger picture out there. There's a bigger story out there than just me. And trying to figure my role in that that overarching story.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because that's fascinating, right? Like it is really, I think accountability today, I was having a conversation with a colleague just a few days ago. We were talking about how hard it is to find people who are accountable. I don't care that you did it wrong or you made a mistake, just fess to it so we can fix it and move on, right? Yeah. And I think some of those, I don't know if that's an old tradition or an old value, you know, like, but I think some of that has been lost over the years, and I hope is coming back in the younger generations. Have you seen different trends in the workplaces around when you're investigating?
I think the trend right now, sadly, on the side where I see some future risks, again, we're a risk management company, is in the current culture clashes between topics such as LGBTQ in the workplace, you know, the clashes between maybe someone's religious beliefs versus someone's protected grounds or protected rights. That is definitely a trend that we're seeing. It is something that I'm telling our clients to say, you need to anticipate the risks that are going to come out here. We just need to read the headlines. We just need to watch the protests going on even in the last month and know that people's opinions, ideologies, frustrations, they're inevitably going to clash in the workplace. What are we going to do with it? Are we ready for it? And I get the opportunity to teach HR professionals in workplace investigations. And I always do a poll. I say, are you seeing an increase in the complaints related to harassment, bullying, discrimination? And I would say probably 95% of the HR professionals I poll across industries across Western Canada have all said they're seeing an increase in complaints.
Wow. So how are they measuring that? Like, are they using technology to measure that? Is that just, office conversations? Like, how are they recognizing that this is a problem?
Well, I mean, for some, obviously, it might be anecdotal, right? For some, for a smaller company. But I mean, obviously, any formal investigation has to be documented. And so they have the documentation. They might say, well, last year we had 15 investigations related to harassment. So, I mean, they've got the internal documentation when I'm asking them what they're seeing within their particular industry. So I believe that, you know, even though, I'm just asking for an anecdotal, are you seeing an increase? They're all saying yes, that they have the statistics behind them as well.
Gotcha. So what's upcoming for Bob in the next couple of years? Bob, what's happening with Veritas? Where are you going? And how can people contact you?
We're really excited. I mean, we're just seeing tremendous growth year over year. We're excited to launch our church and faith-based stream, which is very unique. I don't believe anyone's doing it in Canada. We are increasing our training, our corporate training. So we have a director of corporate training. Her name is Basma Sheikh. And so we truly are, I believe, becoming, if we're not already, becoming the lead human resource risk management firm in Canada. HR risk management, by the way, is a bit of a new idea that you don't find many folks advertising themselves as a human resource risk management firm. So it is definitely a niche area. We've got the expertise, the training behind it. I'm excited because I went from just me and my shingle 5 years ago that if I were to leave tomorrow, that the business itself would continue. We've got
good infrastructure
and a big client base.
And I think, you know, as a consultant, when you first start out and you hang your hat as a shingle as a consultant, that's the biggest mistake consultants make as they grow and scale, right? Is that they formulate the company all around them and their expertise and their client base and network. So congratulations on that. That's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, and we've got a great, great team. Visit our website. We've got some very, very smart people, very decent people, very committed. And so that's what the success is, right? We've got, and that's so I could walk away tomorrow and they would just be just fine and continue to grow.
So, throughout this conversation, what is the one question I didn't ask that I should have?
When did I decide to start dyeing my hair white to look wise?
Happy, I was going to ask if you wear a Santa Claus costume at Christmas.
Well, I must confess, I'm starting to look more like him below the chest than I did about 5 years ago. But
yeah. Oh, good. Well, very good. Well, thanks, Bob, for joining me today.
All right.
Talk about workplace and just to share your story. It's been fascinating.
Well, thanks, Lisa. Thanks very much. You make it very easy to have a conversation.
Oh, very good. Thank you. All right. Goodbye, my friend.
Bye.